You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
Well, I'm ready to preach. We are in a different kind of series, a very unique series. Very different from everything else that we do typically. We started something like this last August when I preached a series called The Gospel and Tom Petty. It was like my favorite series I ever have done. I had so much fun with that. And that was about a six-week series. Well, this August, and every August, I think we're going to do something like this. We'll see. But this August, we're continuing doing a similar kind of series. Again, this is very different from our normal rhythm, but it's just a nice summer change-up. So we're in a series for 4 weeks called Jesus and Pink Floyd. And what it looks like is I've chosen four Pink Floyd songs, one per weekend. And at the beginning of the sermon, we watch a video with the song, with the lyrics, and we reflect on the song. We reflect on the lyrics of the song and what they're saying to us. And then I come back and I preach a normal sermon out of the scriptures, but we do interact with the theme and the lyrics of that song, and perhaps even critique it when necessary, like we did last week. So we're now on our third track of four songs. We've covered two already, and the first two, Money and Time, came from the same Pink Floyd album, 1973, Dark Side of the Moon. But this weekend, we're going to fast forward a few years to 1979, Pink Floyd's epic album, The Wall. And the song that I've chosen from The Wall is Another Brick in the Wall. Actually, the technical title is Another Brick in the Wall Part 2, because there are three songs on that album called Another Brick in the Wall. It's Part 1, 2, and 3. But I just showed y'all's video, by the way. Y'all missed it, McCann family. There they are right there. But they're like, man, where did our video go? So there's three songs called Another Brick in the Wall, Part 1, 2, and 3. But for the purpose of this sermon, we're just calling it Another Brick in the Wall because I know it's going to happen. Is we have people that are not familiar with Pink Floyd, and if I title the sermon Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2, they're going to be confused, like, wait, I missed Part 1. Is it on the podcast? It's not. Why? So just to eliminate all of that, we're going to call it Another Brick in the Wall. But typically when people say Another Brick in the Wall, this is the song they're talking about. So I want us to watch this video and just to kind of set it up, what you're going to see, some of it are scenes from a live concert that they did, I'm guessing in the early 90s or whatever, but much of what you're going to see on this video is footage from the movie, The Wall, because Pink Floyd had a movie called, they made a movie out of this album. So you're going to see scenes from that movie associated with this particular song, and it's very interesting imagery. You're going to see young children, each one of them distinct, unique. They have faces, they have identities, they have their own style. They're unique persons. But these children are marching single file down an assembly line. They're in a factory of some sort, and they're on this assembly line heading towards a piece of machinery. And when they come out on the other side, this machine, this factory, has taken these beautifully distinct, unique children and turn them into faceless, compliant, indoctrinated school children who are now all the same. They're not distinct anymore. They're all the same. And so I really see this song as a critique of institutions, organizations, empires that rob us of our personhood and our identity, our uniqueness, and just treat us as objects, cogs in a wheel, or another brick in the wall. And so I want you to enjoy this song, this video. It's got a little bit of a disco feel to it because it is the late 70s, by the way. And then I'm going to come back, and I got a doozy of a sermon that I'm going to preach on the book of Revelation. So let's look at this video for Another Brick in the Wall.
Classroom.
I love those kids' cute little British accents. Revelation chapter 2, verse 17. Jesus says, "Let anyone who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. To everyone who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give a white stone, and on the white stone is written a new name that no one knows except the one who receives it." But then in Revelation 13, which we're going to look at in just a moment, John tells us about this vision in which he sees a beast rising up out of the sea. And this beastly creature gives to everyone on the earth a number. So here's the whole sermon in one sentence, and then we'll tease it out a little bit. The lamb gives you a name. The beast gives you a number. That's the whole sermon right there in one sentence. We'll extrapolate a little bit, but that's the sermon. The lamb gives you a name. The beast gives you a number. So let's talk about this. We should first acknowledge that the book of Revelation is a very difficult book, isn't it? It's extremely mysterious. In fact, it almost didn't make it into the New Testament because the early church fathers were like, we're not really sure what to do with this. It's an extremely difficult book. And if we're going to dive into the book of Revelation, we should recognize that we need deep humility and we also need a lot of help. We need the help of real substantial scholarship to untangle this book. I promise you, you sitting alone in your bathroom with a notepad, you will not disentangle the book of Revelation. You may think you've got it figured out. I assure you, you do not. We need help, all of us. So it's a very difficult book. But one thing we know about Revelation, among many other things, is that Revelation is a prophetic critique of empire. And as such, it has enduring relevance in all times and places. It's always relevant. So it's a prophetic critique of empire, and in its original setting, it is a prophetic critique of the Roman Empire in particular. John, the Revelator, who's writing this letter, and it is a letter, by the way, it's a letter to seven actual churches that existed in seven cities in Asia Minor, what we call Turkey today, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. John is writing to actual congregations, just like this, actual congregations of believers, and he wants them to know that the Roman Empire is not the kingdom of Christ. In fact, it is the beast. Now, let me first kind of calm some anxieties, perhaps. I know that there are many, many, many Christians, particularly concentrated here in the United States, who have come to believe that this beast that we read about in Revelation 13 is associated with some kind of end times world leader, a person who will unite the world. He will be worshipped, put on a pedestal, and they associate this beast figure with that kind of end of days world leader. And if you happen to be here and you believe that, I want you to just relax. We're not challenging that today. I'm not confirming or denying that. I'm just saying we're leaving that alone today. In fact, you may very well be right. Because one thing about the prophetic writings in the Bible is that they often have different facets of meaning. And as time goes along, sometimes these texts have a way of shape-shifting and the Spirit inspires new meaning for fresh times. That happens several times within the Bible itself. So you may very well be right. I just want you to just relax because we're not even speaking to that. Nothing of what I'm saying today is going to have any bearing on that, okay? So hold your belief and feel good about it. That's fine. But what I do want you to know is that in its original setting, when John is writing about this beast coming up out of the sea, John does have a particular person in mind. He's thinking, first of all, of the Roman Empire personified by the emperor himself. This is what John calls the beast. Not to say the Spirit doesn't inspire new meanings for other times, but the original beast of Revelation, in John's mind at least, is the Roman Empire personified by the emperor himself. And in Revelation chapter 13, in depicting this beast, the Roman Empire, John gives this rather enigmatic phrase. Look at what he says in verse 18. He says, "This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number for a person. Its number is 666. And of course, that last sentence right there, that's what spawned so many horror movies, right? But I want you to notice something. John is telling his readers, you can figure this out if you got enough understanding. I got a person in mind, and if you can calculate the number of this person's name, if you can calculate the numerical value, you can discern who I'm referring to. Now, you and I are at a great disadvantage here because we're separated from John by like 2,000 years of history, which makes it extraordinarily difficult for us to discern what he's talking about. But this is where scholars and historians can help us. Now, again, many people, when they come to this text, they associate 666 with this beast world leader that's going to be worshipped at the end of days. Again, if that's where you're at, that's where you're at. That's fine. I'm not discounting that. Believe that. That's fine. You may be right. But notice what John is doing. He is asking his readers, he's giving them an invitation. He's saying, listen, if you got enough understanding, you can figure it out. I have a person in mind. He's got a specific individual in mind, but he doesn't want to name the person, presumably because it would put him in great danger. So he doesn't want to name this individual. So instead, he encodes the identity of this person in this number. There's a numerical value. It's complicated, but there's a numerical value to the person's name. And he says, if you got enough discernment, you can figure out who I'm referring to. And by the way, with the help of scholarship, we do know who John is referring to. He's talking about Caesar Nero, because the numerical value of Caesar Nero is 666. And when you read Revelation 13, you read about how you have to have the number or the mark of this beast on your right hand or on your forehead if you want to be able to buy or sell. Now, what's that all about? Well, again, this is where scholarship can help us if we will let them help us. And what we know is that in the eastern provinces of the Roman Empire at the time, one of the things that was very common was emperor worship. Not so much in the western part of the empire, because they were too close to Rome. And those people were more cynical. Like they knew too much to be under that delusion that the emperor is a god or something like that. So you didn't see a lot of emperor worship in the West. But in the eastern provinces, the further away you get from Rome, you see a lot of that happening in some of these major cities. So let's say that you're in a major city in the eastern provinces, like, for example, Ephesus, because all of these seven churches were. So you're in Ephesus, and you want to go into the marketplace to buy and sell. Well, right there at the entrance of the marketplace, the Roman Agora there would be a bust of the emperor's face. Whether Nero or Caligula or Domitian or whoever, there would be a bust of the emperor, or maybe I could say it this way, there would be an image of the beast. And the emperor's bust would be there, and underneath would be some live coals. There would be a censer as well, and what you would do is you would take a little pinch of incense in that censer, and you would toss it on those coals, and that was seen as an act, like a token act of worship to the emperor. What you're saying is you toss that incense on those coals, is you're saying, all hail Caesar, the great God. I acknowledge the greatness of the God who is Nero or Domitian or Caligula or whatever. So it was a token act of worship. And once you performed that act, then they would put a mark on your hand, just like they do at concerts and other venues today. They put a mark on your hand, or it could be on your forehead. And once you gained that mark, now you gain admission into the marketplace where you can buy or sell. Well, if you're a Christian living out your fidelity to Christ, of course, you're going to say, no, I'm not going to get involved in that. This is emperor worship. I worship Christ. I'm not going to compromise my allegiance to Christ. I'm not going to take that mark. I'm not going to throw that incense. I'm abstaining from all of that, which, of course, you're going to bring a lot of difficulty on yourself, because now you're not going to be able to enter in and buy or sell. It creates all kinds of problems. Well, this is what John is depicting for us here in wild, poetic, imaginative ways. He is trying to encourage these believers in these seven churches in Asia Minor. He's trying to tell them, listen, just stand firm. I know it's hard. I know it's difficult. There's persecution, but stand firm. You don't belong to Caesar's kingdom. He is not your God. Christ is your king. You're a citizen of Christ's kingdom, and that's the kingdom that wins in the end. Stand firm. That's really what's happening. That's the historical foundation behind what's happening here. So what does that mean for us today? Does that mean that we should be worried about microchips in our pets? No. That's not what we should take from this. But let me say it this way. If what we do with our hands and how we think with our head is complicit with this philosophy, it's the economy, stupid. That everything has to serve the interest of the almighty economy or the almighty bottom line. And we begin to see human beings as just expendable cogs in that machine, just nondescript bricks in the wall. We are thinking like the beast. We are being scripted by the powers and principalities. And as we are, we cannot enter into what God wants to do in the world. Because in the kingdom of Christ, the great goal, the great focus, the great value that supersedes all others is not the economy, as valuable as that might be. It's love for brother and sister. So the beast says, it's the economy, stupid. But the lamb says, love one another, little children. The lamb is all about persons. The beast is all about numbers. And wherever persons are being turned into numbers, the Satan is near. Now, why do I say it like that, the Satan? It might sound a little weird because we're used to calling him Satan like it's a proper name or something. Like that's his first name, Satan Smith or something. And if your last name is Smith, my apologies. But why do I say the Satan? Well, because it's not a name. It's a title. The Satan comes from the ancient Hebrew word of the Old Testament, Hasatan. It's a title. It actually just means the accuser. That's who he is. It's the accuser. It's like saying the devil. The Satan. Get used to saying that. I think it would be good for you. The accuser, the Satan. And by the way, this might surprise you. There are only three stories in the entire Old Testament where Hasatan appears, where we see an appearance of the Satan. Let me just briefly survey them for you. I think this will be good for you, healthy for you. First of all, the earliest story where we see the Satan, where we meet this figure, is early in the book of Job. We're introduced to Job, who is a righteous man who loves and serves God. But in chapter 1 of Job, we see the Satan appear before God in the divine council. And the Satan makes an accusation against Job, because that's who he is. He is the accuser. Remember that. The Satan is the spirit of accusation. He makes an accusation against Job, and he says, you know what? The only reason why Job serves you is because you've blessed him with all of this stuff. Look how prosperous he is. But if you take all of that stuff away, you're going to see how hollow this man actually is. He doesn't really love you. He just loves the stuff. That's the accusation he makes. And so then, as the story unfolds, as Job enters into his trials and he loses his fortune, he loses his children, he loses his health, the Satan seems to disappear from the story. We don't read about Hasatan again. We don't see an appearance again. He just seems to disappear from the story. But in reality, the Satan does not disappear. He just recedes into the background and begins to speak through Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And these three friends of Job, they hear about this horrible, unspeakable series of tragedies that have befallen their friend Job. He's lost his fortune. He's lost his health. He's lost his children. And they come to, we're told, comfort him. And they actually do come and sit with him and mourn with him for 7 days. But then they begin to do what? They accuse him. They bring accusation against him. Why do they accuse their friend Job? Well, it's because when we as human beings, when we encounter horrific tragedies, here's a person, let's say, like Job, who is, maybe they've gone bankrupt, they've lost their material wealth, their health is failing, they've lost their children, people close to them, they've gone through all of this serious tragedy. There's some human instinct in us that deep down says, oh my gosh, I hope that never happens to me. And we'd love to find some guarantee that it would and could never happen to us. And so Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they have to come up with some reason why this has happened to Job. Certainly, it can't just be a simple twist of fate. It can't just be a product of random chance. There must be some reason Job is dealing with this, and it probably has to do with something about Job. Job must have done something to deserve this. He has brought this upon himself. Job has offended God in a horrible way. Therefore, God is bringing righteous judgment against our friend Job. But this whole thing comes out of this need to preserve their own sense of future well-being. They want to assuage their anxieties about their own fate. And so they find it necessary to increasingly and aggressively accuse their friend Job. You see, this is the Hasatan. This is the Satan right here. You could say it like this. There's a sense in which they are possessed. They are giving embodiment to the Satan. And they've gone from being Job's comforters to Job's tormentors. And they're multiplying his sorrow. They have become together the Satan. That's the first story. The second story where we meet Hasatan, it's a little briefer, it's a little more obscure. It occurs in the prophetic book of Zechariah. And in Zechariah has a vision in which he sees Joshua the high priest, not to be confused, by the way, with Joshua and the conquest of Canaan. Those are two different guys separated by about 800 years. But he sees Joshua the high priest standing before God, and in this vision, he sees the Satan appear once again, who brings accusation against Joshua. He points out how filthy his garments are, that this is a man of sin. This man's got sin in his life, and he accuses Joshua before God. And I want you to notice how God responds. God doesn't deny that he's got filthy garments, but look at what God says. "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. Is this not a brand that I have plucked from the burning? Now shut up and go away." I added that last sentence. But that is the implication. That's the second story. The third story, though, is the most mysterious to me. And it's this weird episode involving King David. We're told in 1 Chronicles 21 that the Satan influences King David to number the people of Israel, to take a census. And this is what David does. And in response, God brings terrible judgment upon Israel. God tells David, "David, I'm so upset with what you've done here that I'm going to bring great judgment on this nation. And it's going to be one of three things. You get to choose which one you want. It's either going to be 3 years of famine, 3 months of your enemies defeating you, or 3 days of epidemic disease. What will it be?" And David says, "Well, give me the 3 days of epidemic disease." And that's what happens. And 70,000 people died. That's the story. But we should pause and say, wait a minute, you get that for taking a census? But if you dig a little deeper, what you realize is that actually it's not just a census. He's not just counting how many people are in Israel. David has put his generals in charge of this. Because what he's really interested in is not just counting how many people. He's very curious how many men are of fighting age in this nation. How many men are old enough to bear the sword? Because what David's thinking is, let's build up this army. Man, if we can just conscript enough soldiers into this army, boy, we could really expand this thing. You see, it's the instinct of empire building. David's thinking, we could build up this military, attack to the north, south, east, and west, and man, we could really grow a huge empire here. And we can have more and more and more and more, and I wonder how much more we can gain if I get really aggressive and imperial in my ambitions. And that, too, according to this story, is the satanic. So we could say it this way. The spirit of accusation and the impulse to empire building are the primary manifestations of the Satan in the Old Testament. And that's all under this heading: the lamb gives you a name, the beast gives you a number. See, what got David and Israel in so much trouble is because David started thinking about people not as persons, but as numbers, as objects to use to meet the needs of ego and economic self-interest. David starts seeing human beings as just another brick in the wall in this huge edifice he wants to build. How can I use people to meet my ego needs and economic self-interest? He's gone from knowing persons as names to knowing persons as numbers. And it's the lamb who gives you a name. It's the beast who gives you a number. So let's bring this down now to our level. I want to offer you a few reflections, basically three reflections, before we close this morning. First of all, be suspicious of institutions, including churches, that are too obsessed with numbers. Now, I know what's going to happen is somebody's going to hear this from some other part of the world, some other part of the country. They're going to hear this podcast. They're going to hear me say that. And they're just going to assume, well, that's just what a pastor says when their church is declining in numbers. And that's not the case here. We've had steady growth at Village. I'm not saying it for that reason, but I really do believe it. Now, I will say, I pray that every church grows. I'd love to see more and more people. I'd love to see the whole world come into the kingdom. So I want to see that multiplication. But the Bible is always suspicious about getting too obsessed with numbers, seeing human beings as statistics. In Revelation 7, you know, it talks about the people of God and prophetic symbolic language. And some of you might remember where it talks about the different tribes of Israel, and it numbers them. It gives you a number. It quotes the number 144,000. You remember that? Revelation 7, 144,000. What is 144,000? Well, it's 12 times 12 times 1,000. And I'm not much into numerology, but there is something to it here. That in the Bible, over and over again, 12 is the number for God's covenant people. So we have the 12 tribes of Israel. We also have the 12 disciples of Jesus. And so it's 12 times 12 times the number of exponential increase in the Bible, which is 1,000. So this is a symbolic number that represents the whole community of the people of God. But then if you pay attention, it leaps forward beyond that. And John says, no, I saw gathered before the throne of the Lamb a multitude from the whole world, from every ethnicity, from every language, from every tribe and every tongue. And what does it say? That no one could number. Don't put a number on it. You can't put a number on it. You shouldn't put a number on it. So be a bit suspicious of institutions in general and churches in particular if we become too obsessed with numbers, because it's often based on economic self-interest and ego needs. This is the phenomenon, by the way, of totalitarian regimes. Anywhere in the history of the world, when governments, regimes, administrations become very authoritarian and dictatorial in their approach and methods, they are almost always guilty of turning names into numbers, people into statistics, persons into things that can be used to meet the needs of ego and economic self-interest. That's what the beast always does, and it's what the lamb never does. And this is one of the major themes of Revelation. Another thing to be cautious of when we're talking about numbers and names and all of that, be cautious with forms of communication that turn everything into ones and zeros. And yes, I am talking about you, Internet. I know you're listening right now. Listen, I'm just as connected and as online as anybody here, but I'm also pretty suspicious of all of this and even a little bit concerned because it's so new. Like really, this internet thing, in the scope of the history of the human race, it is super new. It's younger than me. I can remember vividly what life was like before the internet, and I'm grateful for it. It keeps us connected. It's a good thing, but I also don't think we really have a handle on it and what it's doing to us as a people, as individuals. And particularly in these last 2 or 3 years with this explosion of AI technology. It really is magnificent in its potential and its possibility. It is like really amazing. But I also feel like we've let something loose into the world that I don't know we really can wrangle it at this point. So be cautious with forms of communication that turn names into numbers, everything into ones and zeros, binary code, digital. Because vinyl was better anyway, right? By the way, could this be why it's so easy for human beings to become so beastly on social media? You ever notice on social media apps, people will say things to one another that they would never say to an actual flesh and blood human being standing right in front of them. It brings out the beast in us. And we have to be careful with that and even suspicious of it. Last thing. In the second creation account, and by the way, there are two creation accounts in Genesis. I don't know if you knew that. There's the first creation account. We find that in Genesis 1. That's what we think of when we think of the creation account. So it has the 7 days of creation, and God separates light from darkness and earth from sky and land from sea, and then creates the planets and the stars, and then moves on and creates the plants and vegetation, and finally all of these animals. God creates the animals. And then the last aspect, the apex of creation, is when God creates humankind, male and female. But when you turn the page over to chapter 2 of Genesis, we're given a second account of creation that the early scribes of Genesis saw fit to just put side by side. They're two different traditions, but they just put them side by side. But when you dive into the second creation account, you'll notice that the order is altered somewhat, where you have the creation of the man, but then later on you have the creation of the animals. So God creates this man. The woman hasn't arrived on the scene yet. He creates the man, puts the man in the Garden of Eden, this pristine, lush environment. There's all this vegetation and plants and all of that. And so the man is there. He takes care of the garden. He's tending the garden, caring for it. And then eventually God says, you know what? He's lonely. He needs some friends. And then is when God creates from the dust of the earth, just as he did the man, he creates animals and puts them in the garden. And as these animals come before the man, what does he do? He gives them names. He names the animals. And then finally, there's this being that's taken from his side, and he names her. Now, he's Ish, meaning man, but this being who's taken from his side, he gives her a name and calls her Isha, man and woman. And so the first vocation, along with caring for the garden, the first vocation for humankind in Genesis 2 is to give names to things. He names everything. I want to put this statement on the screen for your reflection. I think it's worthy of reflection. Human beings are the ones who make creation a community of the named and known, and not just an impersonal collection of unknown and disassociated things. I like that. Let me help you reflect on that for a moment. You know, we live in this great big universe that's way beyond our comprehension. And there's all this stuff happening, most of which we know nothing about. There's all this stuff happening. Whether we're talking about out in interstellar space or we're talking about on this tiny little blue planet, there's so much stuff happening, most of which has nothing to do with us. We don't even know it's happening. And it would be happening without us, but there would be no sense to it. There would be no story to tell. And so God creates humankind in his image. And humankind says, you know what, I'm going to give names to things and make a story out of this. And instead of this being just a cold world of unknown and disassociated things, it's going to be a community of the named and the known. Because without humanity, the universe is a cold, impersonal collection of objects. That's all it is. But with humanity giving names to things, the universe becomes known and personal. Let me show you an example of what I'm talking about. I want you to look at this picture on the screen. Those are my two dogs. Now, I did a little bit of research this week, and I found out that they estimate there are probably around 900 million dogs in the world. Not quite a billion, about 900 million dogs. And about 75 to 85% of them, and let's just split the difference, about 80% of them, 4/5 of all the dogs in the world, are just out in the wild. They're stray, feral. 80% of the dogs in the world have no names. They're not known. There's no relationship to human beings. They're just wild dogs. They just exist. They're not part of a larger story. But not these two boogers. These are my two dogs. The one on the left is Molly. We got her from the Swanson family. Dave's dog and his sister's dog got together and some stuff happened. And they had a bunch of puppies unintentionally. And so they were looking to give these puppies homes, and they offered Molly to us, and we took her in, and Molly is now part of the Post household. She's 3 years old now, And then the one on the left, the black furry rascal, he was actually a rescue. He was a stray dog wandering the streets of Tijuana somewhere. And through a series of events, we eventually brought him into our household. His name is George Harrison. And we get asked about this all the time. Yes, we're very impressed and proud of George's musical accomplishments. But these two dogs are not cold, impersonal beings, disassociated objects that just exist. These dogs are known, they're named, they're cherished. They have real loving relationships with human beings, and they're part of a larger story. And God willing, both of them will live another 10 to 12 years, and they'll pass away eventually, but C.S. Lewis says, our love eternalizes them. And I like that. That's really part of what it is to be a human being, to fulfill our role, is we take this creation and we make it a community of the known and the named. I think about old St. Francis of Assisi. You know, St. Francis, we're told, had such a love for creation and nature. He would walk around his village talking to trees and animals. He'd be walking around, I don't know how it looked to everybody else, but he'd just walk around and say, good morning, brother tree. Good afternoon, sister bird. A little flaky for some people, I get it, but I like that. He had this kinship with God's creation that drew him into a deeper appreciation and worship for the Creator. And I'm not telling you to walk around your neighborhood and talk to trees, but I do think it's good and healthy for us from time to time. Get outdoors. Go for a walk. Notice the trees, notice the animals, notice the birds, observe them, appreciate them, learn their names, learn their species. When you learn the names of things, you begin to recognize that everything belongs. Everything has its right place. Everything starts to feel a little more holy, a little more sacred in the world. Just speaking about myself, I want to get better at learning the names of things. I want to learn the names of mountains, and streams, and rivers, and species of animals. I think that's a healthy thing. And if I don't know their names, I'll just give them names. You know, that's Mount Custer right there. So I say, get outdoors and learn the names of Brother Tree and Sister Bird. Or better yet, have a conversation with a real human being. You know, the most primitive form of communication is not writing. And it's certainly not texting or Facebook statuses. It's this primitive, earthy gift of language that we have face-to-face. So have a conversation. Have a meaningful conversation today. That's my assignment to you. Or how about this? Resolve to go to a restaurant with a friend or some friends and decide to put your phone down and not look at it one time for an entire hour. Could you do that? Are you capable of that? To never once disappear into the discarnate world of numbers and ones and zeros. This has been a theme here for the last few weeks. Be present and give one another the gift of presence. People are sacred. We are names. We are not numbers. The beast gives us a number. And you're just a nondescript brick in the wall. But the Lamb gives us a name. Amen. God, we have heard your word today by your Spirit. And we've reflected upon the difference between the way of the Lamb and the way of the beast. The difference between being named and known or being numbered and used. And we confess, Lord, how easily we fall into the ways of the world and how often we measure one another's worth by utility or by status or by economy or by statistics. But today we remember that we are not numbers to you. We are your children, known by name, each one beloved. So as we come to the table of communion today, we come not as cogs in a machine, not as bricks in a wall, not as data points in a system, but we come as persons invited by the Lamb who was slain. The one who calls us by a name only he knows. The one who feeds us with hidden manna. The one who gives us a white stone of grace. Lord, may this bread and this cup remind us again that in Christ we are not forgotten. We're not lost in the crowd. We're not faceless. We are remembered. We are restored. We are renamed. So make this table a place of presence, a place of communion with you, with each other, here in the flesh and also in the spirit. And as we eat and drink, may we learn again the way of love, the way of the Lamb, the way that sees every person as sacred. And we pray this in the name of Jesus.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.